Hallo. Hallo. Entschuldigung, I sort of lost my voice today. Aaron may be able to talk more. But we had a very small problem. We had a lot of people bring their EXOs to the conference, which is awesome. The green laptops. And we had one that nobody claimed last night. It has a funny name tag. Karamush. But we decided that rather than take it apart, we'd just give it away tomorrow. So we're going to give it away to whoever comes up with the best product idea for it. But Aaron, okay. You could explain a little bit about the project.
Okay. So there is a developers program coming, a new one, and basically we want that in case like you have a good project idea, just present it, write it in the wiki, laptop.org/go/contributors, and basically there is good news, there is going to be 200 XOs for developers and for your local CCC groups. So I guess Karamona doesn't show up, so somebody can have that with a good project idea outside. Okay, thanks.
And now coming up, the talk from Tony, Tomislav, Dimitri, and Marcel on ideological and political aspects of free software and open source. The talk is called Hacking Ideologies Part 2, Open Source, a Capitalist Movement. Enjoy.
Hi everyone, this is part 2 of something we started at What the Hack a few years ago. It was at that time a spontaneous reaction to an introduction talk at the What the Hack event, where I was provoked by the use of language like terms like democracy and freedom of speech without actually qualifying what do we mean when we say those words, those terms. Especially at the time, and I still live in UK for past, 11 years now, and you know, coming from UK at that time during What the Hack, where the Iraqi war was at the in the media pretty much in your face 24/7, freedom of expression and freedom of speech and democracy meant something completely different living in UK. They meant justification for attacking Iraq. So unless you qualify, how do we differ from what the establishment and the states mean by it, then you know, we are simply using their propaganda for their own benefit. We're repeating them like parrots. In few words, I'll just say of the notion of ideology and why I'm doing this. The basis of ideology is the way I want to talk about it here, is the existence of a common language, of something that binds us. And probably the most important notion is fantasy, which arises spontaneously between subject who speaks. So I speak and there is a common belief. Hi? Okay, so is it still good enough like this? Because I can't hear myself now. Yeah, okay. Is this better? Right. So, normally, I assume that you will understand what I'm talking about, and you do the same act, you assume that I understand what, the, vice versa, but that doesn't happen. What actually happens most of the time is a fantasy. We both imagine that we're being understood simply for the sake of, well, having a communication, having a language. So it's a leap of faith. Every communication is a leap of faith. And I think that the role of critique of ideology is to break that leap of faith. It's to actually unbind the binding spontaneous solidarity between the communicative agents. And that's what I'll try to just introduce with talking about the free software and open source initiative. I wasn't really interested at the beginning into it. It was simply by reading, you know, page by page of various accounts of the history, how it happened when the open source split, that I got quite surprised by the level of justification by the open source guys who said, we are just doing it for the sake of doing it. You know, we don't have any ethical or ideological beliefs. We're just doing it because we need business involved. And That's pretty much the bottom line of the talk from my side. I'll talk another 10 minutes and then we'll each talk for 10 minutes and then hopefully we'll have some questions and a bit of clarifications or whatever needs to be said. So what surprised me most is how clear it was that when Eric Raymond, reading historic documents, well, now historic, 10 years is a long time, how clear it was that they wanted to exclude Richard Stallman from it and what were the reasons. And their claim was, we are not ethical, we don't have ethics per se, we just want to get some funds involved so we can move it to a different level. And it's quite shocking to me still today that it's commonly accepted that that's how it is. Open source is not ideological, open source is not, has no claims which are ideological. While at the same time, you know, the usual truth of Free Software Foundation is the ethics, almost the religious, and, you know, the behavior of Richard Stallman, who reacts strongly when his ethics or beliefs are challenged. So I think what open source initiative showed that between Free Software Foundation claims and between what happened till that time and the capitalist neoliberal economy, there was a gap that needs to be bridged by an institution. And that's what open source initiative did. I don't think it was possible to include free software as it was in the economy. So it is understandable why they did it. What prevents us to think the use of technology in society in ways which are other than profit-driven, clear-cut capitalist economy is thinking of it as non-ideology, thinking of it as, you know, just doing it. We're the pragmatists, it's fine. We don't have any claims. So I think there is a bit of work to be done there to remove that claim from its own, to remove its own truth foundation, so to say. What's more amazing is that when I talk to people who have science degrees, and back where I work in London, people who even have science PhDs and spend their lifetimes in labs hacking software, for them, capitalism isn't ideological because it's not based on axioms, you know, because it hasn't got its own manifesto, so to say. While at the same time, science is perfectly axiomatic and it has foundations which aren't there to be challenged unless you want to set up a completely new paradigm, a revolution in science. So it is perfectly acceptable in science, but we can't have axioms or ethics in anything else, because if we do so, then we're accused, like Free Software Foundation gets all the time of. Earlier, I think the fantasy, the most important fantasy for me that we in West buy into well, that we build unconsciously when we live here, is something to do with the previous talk. I was only 10 minutes into it about spies because it's a fascinating subject, and I'll have to watch it all now when I saw 5 minutes of it. Is the claim that the British Parliament wanted to remove the history of 700 years of history of English Parliament by being able to abolish each parliamentary act passed simply by a stroke of a minister. And presenter earlier said that that's terrible because we're losing history of democracy. Well, this is, I think, fundamental fantasy. I think that the liberal democratic concept of liberal democracy is a fantasy which serves. Well, it serves to keep the society coherent to an extent. And I don't think we'll lose anything if ministers in UK can sign off the history. I think that's great. And I didn't know about the law, and I'm really pleased. I'm really pleased it's been there, and I hope that the Lords will change their mind on it. As to the word totalitarian used in a previous presentation, I have tried a couple of times. I just finished in London sociology at Goldsmiths, and I've tried to use the term sociology on a few occasions, but I was shot down in flames because there are piles and piles of books who claim that, you know, East Europe socialism, that was the totalitarian society, and we live in our enlightened society where we can discuss things and we are democratic and so on and so on. I think the situation is quite the opposite, and the presenter saying earlier that the fact that no one believes anymore the mainstream media in UK means that it's we're getting close to totalitarian society. I think that's not the problem. I think the problem is that we still consider our society to be democratic, and we still consider parliament as the means to progress for everyone. I think that's a real problem. So by having capitalism in our minds as a non-ideological, as the objective truth of our world today, by treating it as such, we're basically blocking any possible change, even discussing it. There are a couple of issues which are side effects of this when I did the research last year, and one is, in a more concrete terms, what can be done. I found that as soon as I finished my degree, all access to all online libraries which I had as a student was withdrawn, actually a week before even my student card expired. And when I talked back to the staff, people at colleges there, the predominant answer was, well, you know, that's just how it is. You're not a student anymore, sort of. But the argument that they agreed with but couldn't swallow and act on is was that to a vast extent in Europe, education has been paid for by the state. So the books that academics produce are paid by everyone, pretty much by citizens, by taxpayers. Yet, as soon as they're produced, they get encapsulated in private publishers who pretty much don't do anything these days because you can just run off your, send them your PDF and it's pretty much with few small corrections ready for print, including even editorial these days being done on the side of people who write books. So we as a society produce and the private capital encloses it in, you know, a normal, probably most of you know this, but normal price of an article goes to £15-20 or $15-20 and it's a 5 or 10 page article. So yeah, they all agree with me. I still haven't had a single person which disagreed with me who works in academia in UK on the principle that everything that's published in academia should be, you know, free to share and should be under one of the licenses which allow us to share it. Yet none of them are ready to act for it because the system forces them to act in a certain manner to get their jobs and to get their careers on the line. So I don't think we are so blind at the ideology. I think it's very convenient to see it the way we see it. So that's one of the issues where next few years I'll try to do some work. And one of the use cases that's being suggested to me at my current place of study, which is London School of Economics, postgraduate in sociology as well, was, well, we could do simply Firefox straight to Torrent so that when students who, I mean, in thousands download from various completely closed networks, various texts and complete books these days, when they do so, that without their knowledge, it actually gets created as a torrent and it gets onto networks so that people can see it outside. That would be a short hack how to expose at least the expose the closed networks to the wider audience. And the second thing, before I finish, second thing is drugs, as drugs, AIDS and malaria. I didn't do much research into this, but the little bit that I did as well shocked me when I found out that, well, shocked me, it didn't shock me, but I was a bit surprised how much, given how much ideological PR goes into private companies saying, oh, we invest so much research into it, we invest so much money, we have to recoup the cost. That's, in case of UK, that's lie, because it is paid by the taxpayers again. It's the government that has contracts which are in billions, literally, of pounds to fund the research. So it is, again, taxpayers' money, which then gets encapsulated for 20 years. And the clear-cut result of that is, and there is no doubt to this when you talk to people from Africa who are trying to push this agenda further, is that millions of people a year, every year, are dying because they don't have access to AIDS and malaria drugs. And they're not asking for drugs to be shipped there. They're asking for a recipe. They want to make them. So one of the ideas I had was, why don't we try to push this forward as well, you know, having free drugs as a concept. Why not? It's paid by us anyway. So there is no private capital, or private capital is a small part of what gets invested into producing those drugs. And also the question that I want to raise is, what is the difference between the Holocaust and the current capitalist regime, which doesn't kill directly millions in Africa and Asia, but it does clearly prevent them from being cured by not allowing drugs to be produced for free, by not, you know, by using patent as economic means of protection. What's the difference between millions being killed within a few years or millions being killed each year? I think the difference is that we live in a far worse system than we think we are. And I think that the terror scare. If there is a terror in the world, it comes from us, and we are the terror engine that drives world to extremes. And that's second thing, and I'll finish with basically, I think we should, and this is a just kind of anarchist activist friends. Well, it's easy to get an agreement from them about piracy, that we should do it and we should just disregard the law. What is the law but the fiction that gets created? I mean, there is a term called legal fiction. It's not there for nothing. It's because when it started, there was no law to start with. So I think I fully agree with Pirate Bay when they announced that they will not discuss those issues anymore. I think we should just discuss how to break those laws and how to publish what can be published in a digital form from closed networks to open networks. And anyone who's got any ideas afterwards to talk about how can we hack something in Firefox so it's easy when you download a text or a file of certain type, so it's easy to publish it in torrent. If there's something, if it exists and I'm not aware of it, I'll be really glad if someone points me towards it. And that's all for me. And next is Marcel.
Thanks. Okay, so this sounds quite serious, so at least I will look a little bit less serious. So analyzing capitalism and ever-going question, will it collapse or will it conquer the world? Reminds me on ever-going question, is GNU/Linux ready for desktop? So I'll try to answer from the same perspective. So I can say that with a little bit of tweaking, it works for me. And I know a lot of Ubuntu people for which it just works out of box. And I know of a lot of people who are very annoyed and who are sick of waiting so the system would work for them. So it's the same for Linux desktop and for the capitalism. And the main problem is that I don't know of annoyed people. I don't know of them personally. Just as I can't see any of them, people who are annoyed by Linux desktop and capitalism, here at CCC. So I would say that it works for us. For some of us, it works just out of box. And for some of us, it just works with a little bit of tweaking. And I'll try to come up with some specific examples which makes me think about that phenomena in quite careful and tricky way. So I don't think that there is really simple critique of that we just should be scared when someone says interest, capital, and things like that, and that's usually happens. So the capitalism, just as Linux desktop, is assimilating and appropriating ideas from the outside. The big problem is that capitalism is so much better than Linux desktop in doing that. So one of the examples how capitalism looks like these days is quote from one ad, and it goes, the CyberNow generation is intrinsically an anarchist, endlessly anti-authoritarian, and hates corporate America. Therefore, this is not an ad for Coke. We repeat, this is not an ad for Coke. And it was ad from Coca-Cola in 1996. So, yeah, that's how capitalism can be smart and in which way it can talk to us. So that process is just happening over and over again. And there is a great book by Thomas Frank, Conquest of Cool, which just analyzing how counterculture was assimilated and appropriating from capitalism from the 60s. So there was one assimilation by capitalism which is quite appropriate for this talk, and that's the idea that software doesn't have to be closed commodity on the market. So yeah, that you can make some money. So that was appropriated by Red Hat, by IBM, by Novell. So they are representatives of that smart capitalism which realized something which is quite different than the regular capitalism which we see regularly and which we critique regularly. So I would say that in that sense, that was a big success both from free software movement and open source movement. And during last 20 years, capitalism realized that in digital world, actor can compete with its competitor with being more open. So that openness is just one of the strategies how you can actually be successful on the market. So I'll just say one example. MySpace was very, very closed. No photos for non-members. It was quite ugly, and we know everything about MySpace, and it was very closed and very, very popular. And then Facebook just came out with the developers API, so it was a little bit more open, but still closed. And then Google is trying to get into that area, being even more open with open social. So we could see that's a strategy which is assimilated by the capitalism, and if you go really radically in that direction, we should think of when capitalism is not anymore capitalism, when it goes that much open. So just imagine 20 years from now that if someone would tell you that people will be able to sell anything from their home directly to anyone else in their home, and that one will just will need to bid, and the other will then, when it gets money, it will just send the money, and that's eBay, and it's a huge scale. And the other example is again the quote from guy from Yahoo Music, and he was targeting the music industry. And so he had the representatives of the huge biggest fattest guy from the music industry, and he said, "I will not spend another dime paying engineers to build false control, making listening to music harder for music lovers. I will put all of my energy into making it easier and making the experience better. I suggest to you to do the same." So at the same time, you have people who didn't really assimilate music industry, who didn't really assimilate what's going on with in digital world, and then someone saying the same thing with any anti-capitalist will say at this moment when we'll target when we target the music industry. So also just some time ago, if you imagine that some state. Just a second. Said if state offered anyone infrastructure where they can pay per processor cycle, so building infrastructure where people will be able to pay per processor cycle or bit information from the storage, so very, very optimized system where you actually pay at the scale which is appropriate, for you. So then you can upscale as your business or whatever you do as it goes. So it can upscale to the Amazoning scale. So that's what Amazon is offering these days. So their product and what they actually provide is a infrastructure which can be used even against them, or competing with them, or competing with any other a big player on the market today. And I have prepared also one more example, and that's the what Google and how Google assimilated the what's going on these days. And Google is a very peculiar one and very tricky one. So I'll try to say something a little bit more before I get back to Google. So,
good couple of minutes more.
Yeah, I think that I'm fine with a couple of minutes. So I would like to say something about state and essential common resources and building infrastructure. So state used to be guardian and provider of very essential infrastructures built on top of common resources. So you just need to think of water supply, highways, rails, and etc. And by time, state becomes so corrupted and inefficient comparing to the market that most of the tasks which state was supposed to do was just outsourced. So that's how they call it. So most of the tasks which fights which they actually need to do are just given to the businesses, and they forgot all of most in most of the countries they just forgot that task. So actually there is an empty space where there are not really big actors which will fight for commons, for things which are just our in the society, and which will really do the dynamic policing and policies of how actually to access the resources. Just imagine the radio frequency spectrum, which probably won't change for forever, and it can be much more accessible these days to everyone, but states won't do that because state just lost that that role in the society. And we could see that we got some other actors in the society to fight that fight. And one of the examples is definitely Free Software Foundation fighting for more commons, and the other civic actors. And what we can see at the latest stage of capitalism is that that the new essential infrastructures which are building on top of resources, because we could just imagine that the infrastructure, the communicational infrastructure, is some kind of invisible, and it's just resource. And Google, Yahoo, Amazon, and eBay are building the big, huge scale infrastructures which are owned and governed by them, and they love their citizens. So they are the new states, and they love their citizens. They provide to their beloved citizens a lot of products and services free, as in free air, or cheap, as in cheap water. And they like to talk sweet. So they really behave like states, and it's very tricky, just as Coca-Cola ad, which I mentioned before. So I will just, for the end, I will just show you one example how Google actually appropriated the sweet talk to their citizens. So one guy did the Gaia.
Make it short, myself. Make it short.
Okay, I'll make it short. Yeah. So he did the open source Google Earth client because we didn't have Google Earth on any free software. So he did something which was illegal. If you imagine how Microsoft or any other big business will approach that guy, it's not really how Google did it. So Google did it. Michael Jones, the chief technologist of Google Earth, Google Maps, and Google Local Search, brought to the author, and he was saying things like, "We appreciate that you like our software and enjoy the many millions of dollars and years of labor that the licensed data represents. Unfortunately, your curiosity about the protected server mechanisms ignores the Google Earth Terms of Service, the software license agreement that you accepted when installing Google Earth, the built-in encryption mechanisms with the client-server protocol, the economic rights of a worldwide network of providers who license this data to Google, and most of all, the sense of fair play that is the basic relationship between Google and its users worldwide. The kindness through which Google has made the wonder of our planet available to more than 100 million users around the world is now threatened. Not by I don't know how to pronounce that in English, and fierce business's competitor, but by you. I'm not an attorney. We remain hopeful that this was an unintended result of what started as intellectual curiosity by smart engineer like ourselves, who has a passion to learn how things work. We really need to have you take down that code and refocus your work toward building an open earth viewer that uses open earth images such as NASA or licensed earth images, blah, blah, blah. So it's very, very, they love their citizens, they love their smart citizens, so they will do everything they can, and I just can't really imagine the state which will do the same. So in that sense, this is not the capitalism which we usually criticize. This is the capitalism which changed quite a lot, and I think that we should rethink actually and what we think about capitalism and communism in digital world. Yeah, thank you very much.
One of the points that we were discussing yesterday, and one of the points that Marcel wanted to get across, was that in this book that he mentions, The Conquest of the Cool, by Tom Frank, what he claims is that at some point in the 50s, the advanced capitalism, 50s, 60s, appropriated practices of counterculture, not so much in order to create new products, which it could sell to counterculture consumers, but rather it appropriated the practices of counterculture in order to revolutionize the management structure. So you can imagine they had at the time old management mind frame, which was very hierarchic, very inflexible, and with new countercultural practices and methodologies, what they could do, they could replace that old mindset, replaced the people who represented that mindset and created so-called flexible capitalism. So that was sort of a true ruse of capitalism appropriating counterculture. And we were discussing yesterday, and Marcel said, well, we should now do the opposite. We should parasite the capitalist. The capitalism. We should parasite the infrastructure that it manages to create, and strange muted form of public infrastructure that it provides. Well, climbing up here, we were asked, what does hacking ideologies means? And it got me thinking, and it could be turned. It's not only about ideologies of hacking or hackers or hacker practices, hacker culture. It's also very much how practices of hacking, particularly free software hacking, have transformed how we think about ideologies. If we consider critique of political economy, such as Marxian critique of political economy, the results of that were attempts to create communist societies, but which were basically focused around one segment of critique of economic relations, and that is relations of production. And we oftentimes like to see free software as and other forms of peer production and production of commons as a problem of how to create community, right? Like Wikipedia, how common goods are created through communal effort, distributed effort, and how finally workers get the ownership of what they've created. And that was very much what real socialist societies tried to do. They try to create worker-owned enterprises, and the whole issue was of solving the problem of capitalism was how to give back to producers the tools of production and the processes of production, so relations of production. However, most of these efforts have ignored the other side of Marxian critique of political economy, and that is the critique of circulation of goods and consumption. So, for instance, in former Yugoslavia, where I come from, there was immediately after the Second World War big debate when they wanted to introduce the worker-owned companies and autogestion by workers. Whether there should be a property form or not. And in the end, property form theory won, and we had property in a very strange way, but nonetheless, we still had property, private property. And this is where I think that free software sort of kicks in. Richard Stallman was very adamant in emphasizing that free software is not so much about producers, but it's primarily about users, giving power to the users, and not how we can give ownership of means of production and processes of production back to producers. So it's not so very much about if software hackers own copyright and can make it free, but it's much more like we don't need ownership because the primary perspective, ethical perspective, is that what we get in terms of goods, we can freely share, we can copy and distribute. So it's about exchange, it's about circulation, and much less about production. And in this sense, I would say that this stress upon user perspective in free software cuts across the division between communism and capitalism. I don't think that either of those categories, from the perspective of critique of ideology, fit quite what the attempt was behind Solman's formulation. They just don't clarify this very specific idea that ownership does not belong to the producers, but that there is a social contribution which is viewed from the perspective of sharing, from the perspective of users, from the perspective of users qua producers and producers qua users. And this is, I think, very important point that what free software creates is a sort of continuum of exchange between producers and users, users qua producers, producers qua users, and that that continuum of exchange is primarily a continuum of knowledge. Therefore, I think that we should maybe try to also reflect how this intervention that didn't have anything to do with the critique of material economy, but had all to do with immaterial economy, basically cuts across these categories which were produced to create a critique of material economy, so communism and capitalism. Thank you.
Hello, can you hear me? Is this thing on? Hi, my name is Dimitri Kleiner. I'm with a workers' collective here in Berlin called Telekommunisten, and I'm involved in a project of hacking ideologies called venture communism. In the opening, we heard from Tony Prug a quote from Eric Raymond that he wants to make free software more favorable to investors and managers. And this is, I think, sort of the key point of departure between the open source movement and the free software movement, this idea of pleasing investors and managers, making free software more appealing to them. So it's an interesting question. What would make free software more appealing to them, and why isn't free software appealing to them? Who are investors and managers? Well, investors are the administrators of finance capital. They're the people that represent the great pools of capital that that is made available to fund startups. And managers are the instruments of their control. So managers are the extensions of capital control. What would make them happy? Well, one thing is to understand what capitalism is. So what is capitalism? Capitalism, simply defined, is a system of class stratification whereby a certain segment of society has removed itself from direct production by controlling the means of production of the direct producers and appropriating their product for redistribution. So getting in the middle of the direct producers and their instruments of production, appropriating the product for redistribution, and being able to control the distribution of the product. This is what capitalism is, right? So capitalism is requires control. It requires control of the productive process, and in particular, the control of the output of the productive process, the actual product to be redistributed. So the sort of problem with free software is not so much any of the principles of the GPL. I mean, of course, the share-alike principle is a certain problem because of the inability to, you know, extend and capture. But the real problem is the emphasis on freedom, because in order for capitalism to function, capitalism requires control. So what Eric Raymond really means when he talks about the negative stereotypes of the Free Software Foundation types in the free software community is the emphasis on freedom that community tends to have. And he wants to change that to an emphasis on pragmatism, to an emphasis on efficiency and productive utility. And of course, capitalism itself is not inherently opposed to that. Free software is by no means the only example of a standard intellectual input that is used widely in production. I mean, there's very banal examples of things like standardized nuts and bolts or international standards of measures or the myriad of ITU and ISO industry standards. The idea of having standard intellectual components that all capitalists use that make production more efficient is not itself new, dangerous, or radical. What is interesting about free software is what's implied by peer production processes, by unmediated, uncontrolled production processes that emphasize freedom and sharing and that lack this controlling element of directly controlling property. Right? So the purpose of making free software more appealing to investors and managers is exactly that, is by offering the means to describe free software in terms that don't imply freedom, don't encourage freedom, but actually encourage utility. And it's a rephrasing of the argument more than it is than a rephrasing of its methods or its principles. It's a rephrasing of the argument from being phrased in a way that might lead you to challenge the actual relations of production and the actual relations of producing and sharing to a way that accepts the extension of control and allows you to embody control within the system of production. I think I'll leave it at short. It's a very sort of complicated topic, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask either during this or after. Thank you very much.
So I guess it's to you whether you have any comments or questions or clarifications.
Okay, I got a comment to you. Sorry, I didn't get your name.
Tony,
okay. Normally I would like to comment your ideas, which I find really interesting, but you really got me angry with one thing. I think it's absolutely unacceptable, your comparison between capitalism and Holocaust. That really got me, that's really absolutely unacceptable. Okay, I think I don't have to explain that.
It's a
huge difference of everything. If you kill people because you want to kill them and no reason or if you take cynically in account that millions of people die like capitalism does, and yeah.
I've got no comment. I mean, I'm glad I made you angry. That was the point. I mean, I hope it makes you think.
Well, I have a slightly less ideological point. I am involved in the software patent debate, and if you talk to the people who favor those patents, they say, well, we really need those patents because we have to protect our business against too fierce competition. And then I say, well, but you do live in a capitalist world where free competition is the core of the capitalist world. So actually,
free competition is the opposite of capitalism. Capitalism is about control of the means of production to extract surplus value. Competition reduces the price of anything to its actual production costs. Competition and capitalism are completely incompatible. In order for anybody to capture value by owning things, they have to eliminate competition because competition actually reduces price.
Yeah, yes, then indeed we talk about the very same paradox, because usually the people who favor capitalism are the same people who are liberal people who try to favor the free market. So we probably agree, I think.
When they talk about the free market, they mean their right to privately own the natural resources that everybody depends on.
I mean, sorry, just as a short comment to this before you ask a question. One thing that we didn't mention here, which came up through completely different projects and thoughts of research, was that with all the talk about intellectual property and, you know, how great it is to have things, to share things, and to have them so easily available, ultimately it is still the land on which everything gets produced and on which we live. And in country where I live, in UK, in England actually, the land registry is closed and you can voluntarily disclose what land you own, but you're not entitled to do so. And if you research into it, people have a legal right to stop you from finding what land you own. And I think, you know, being the mother of one of the places where industrial revolutions happened in the most extreme ways, it shows why. I don't think it's for nothing. I think it's symptomatic of something else, which is for us convenient not to discuss or not to think about the land. So, sorry, go on with the question.
What I want to ask you is your opinion of the idea that capitalism means to generate more value, and the sharing of knowledge and the sharing of ideas is a way to generate more knowledge and more ideas. So somehow it's similar, I think.
What's your action? Can you be clear?
When you share your knowledge, you make it possible to take it by others and, generate new programs, new source code, for example. So I think somehow it fits very good to capitalism, because the generation of more...
You mean creation of more knowledge is good for capitalism?
Is,
you think it's
one thing that capitalism has a problem with, because if you have limited resources, you cannot create more. But in the case of immaterial goods, this just doesn't work. So you can generate more and more.
But for me, I mean, I'll be short on this and let you say, but for me, this is not about more. And on this, we disagree on a lot of things, I think, which is healthy. But on this, Adam Curtis, the BBC documentary maker who did a series of fantastic documentaries, especially the last few years, he gave an interview recently to the Register, and I encourage people to read it. It was maybe a month ago, where I completely agree with him, and two of them completely disagree more or less, is that by producing what we call knowledge production today is a complete stupidification of society, from my view. I think I feel much more stupid than I was when I was 20 years old. You know, it's by having more, by having blogs, by having networks, by having exchanges, we are keeping communication on a very shallow, superficial level. And simply on a level which allows us to, you know, be very verbose and non-reflexive. So for me, it's not the question of more. It's a question of different, hence hacking ideologies, because we are more stupid than we were as 10 years ago, I think, as a society. And I think this comment, someone being angry, you know, about the Holocaust, and just look at the numbers and look at what's being done. Why do we not give those drug patents for free to Africa and Asia, and whoever needs them to cure the people? It's simple.
This is fad against capitalism. I strongly disagree.
Sorry?
My English sucks, man. I would like to say something on the...
I was just going to comment on the first question. I'm not so interested in talking about the Holocaust. Capitalism, as the woman said, is not so much about making money, because, I mean, money is just sort of a wealth counter, so to speak. So what we're really talking about is creating wealth, and of course, what creates wealth is work. Labor creates wealth. Capital is about making money from other people's work, right? So capitalism is about extracting money, not so much about making money, right? And when you talk about information, capitalism is also interested in information, insofar as information allows workers to be more productive and thus create more wealth to extract. Right, so capitalism sees information in a very utilitarian sense, which is why they fund public education. Why public education is supported by capital is because it lowers the wages of certain classes of intellectual workers. And so the kind of information that capitalism is interested in is the kind of information that enhances productive capacity. The kind of information capitalism isn't interested in is the kind of information that emphasizes, you know, other aspects of life that aren't involved in productive work, or especially the kind of information that questions the system and the question information about the nature of capitalism is not the kind of information they want you to have.
Hello, that's a very interesting talk. Thank you for coming there. I have a question about the new states that are being created, like Google, which is kind of new state. Compared to, this is a private state, and compared to a public state that we are living in right now, there is no guarantee for such as democracy inside these states. So maybe sometimes at Google or something that are very cool, doing very cool things, and they are maybe more open than some of the states we are living inside. But in the states we are living in we have a way of controls, which is democracy. And there is no such thing in Google states or private states that are maybe coming in the future. How can we do to just make these private states being more democratic? Thank you.
Yeah, I can answer that. I had the last paragraph, so it seems to me as a hammer, so whoever asked the question, I would just use this hammer. That was a nail for me. So yeah, I agree, but I think that many things are coming from the design and architecture of the infrastructure, that's not just the intention or that people are so evil that they want to exploit. I mean, they are, but it's not just about that. So it's very about the perspective. So if you are an actor on the market, then yes, you want monopoly, you want as bigger share on the market as possible. But in general, that there is almost no perspective on that, but from state to say, like, we need people competing and things like that. So I think it's really about what is your perspective, and here I can't see really a lot of entrepreneurs, so we will all agree, like, capitalism sucks, you know. But yeah, I think that there is some kind of balance, because my life in socialism just show me that it doesn't really always cut the prices when, you know, when you have whatever. But
the worker state of the East is only one and one highly controversial.
I just realized that when there is something which we can say that that's not the real competition, but when there is some kind of competition, it cut the prices. So I'm not trying to say that capitalism is great, but just saying that there is some kind of space in between. And I think that it's really about the design and architecture of the infrastructure. So and the infrastructure of communication, which we have now, tends to bring us Google and the other, like, very centralized. But how they actually compete is that inside they build systems which are distributed, and then they compete with, you know, who is actually more able to upscale. And the only way how they can do that is to do the distributed computing. So in that sense, yeah, it's really about when they will be forced, because they won't do that just because of their intentions, how they will be forced to actually come up with part of these infrastructures which they are building inside. So that will be part of the public infrastructure which we have now. So I see it as a possible progress where we'll have more of that in the future. So as I said at the beginning, is Linux ready for desktop? I think that that's irrelevant and outdated. So for me, it's much more when we will be able to build a huge global peer-to-peer BitTorrent-like encrypted and anonymized network infrastructure, so we will be able then to say fuck off to Google, Amazon, eBay, and the others. But at this stage, I just can see that
how are we going to build that network, and how are we going to finance that network? Peer-to-peer technology has a great potential for changing the way we work, changing the way we share, changing the way all of our applications work. But the creation of any kind of technology requires the application of wealth, and the application of wealth has to come from some pool of accumulation. It can't come out of the sky or just drop from nowhere. And capital, finance capital, won't finance peer-to-peer peer-to-peer technology, because peer-to-peer technology offers no point of mediation where value can be captured. So capitalism will only fund the kinds of technologies which are centralized, in which one central point is a key point where value can be captured and where control can be exercised. Peer-to-peer technology does not offer this mechanism, and so peer-to-peer technology will never receive any venture capital. And if you look at the actually existing internet, the only areas where peer-to-peer technology has any kind of footprint at all are in the very primitive areas of the early internet, things like email and Usenet that are mostly obsolete now, and criminal areas like file sharing that are completely at the margins of capitalism because they're used to actually break capitalist laws. In the actual big thing, the whole point of Web 2.0 is to achieve some of the promises of peer-to-peer technology, but in a centralized way, using web servers, using centralized technology to create user content, to create like folksonomies and stuff like that, but without actually letting the users control the technology itself. So it doesn't run on their own computers, on their own network facilities. It runs on centralized data centers at YouTube and Google and things like that. So therefore, it's ownable and controllable. So yes, I agree that the only time we can really sort of challenge the capitalist systems that control the internet is once we have these technologies, but you can't fund the technologies unless you can first accumulate the wealth to provide for their creation.
I would say, what would you say, like in 1985, will there be any investments in something like non-private property in software? So that happened. So in that sense, it's really.
What do you mean?
I mean that if we will be in the 80s, and if we will talk about what will happen with the free software or copyleft approach, then you would probably say that there is no way that will succeed.
And that's not true. Free software is no different.
In the same way, file sharing just killed the recording industry. I think that this was probably one of the last.
I haven't noticed its death, actually.
Recording industry, Christmas, so in that sense,
it's alive and well, and in charge of your television and your record store and every aspect of your culture and media.
Let's take more questions.
Yeah, exactly.
We have time for one short more question.
Okay, this is going to be really hard to make short, but the letter from the chief technologist of Google was very fascinating to me to see how much an idea of freer culture can leak in, but it also kind of pointed out to me how much sometimes the technology sector doesn't see the larger picture of things, because Google is trying to suck in as many possible users because the system has sort of shifted to where the value is in the information it can suck from all the users, and so there is a very dark side, of course, to where Google is operating to get more people to operate within it. So I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, I agree. I hope that you don't see me as a propaganda for Google, because if these days in my environment, when you don't say that they are evil, then you are a promoter of Google, and I'm like, fuck, man, no, I'm not. But yeah, I don't see that as the evil.
Any more? No? Okay, thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you for talking.